Let's get started this morning. Let's open in prayer and then we'll dive in. Let's pray. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for this chance to be together again this morning. We ask your blessing on the church and on the world and on this class. We pray that you allow us to sift out what is true from what is not, what is good from what is not, so that we can take something away from this class today and from the service that we can then take into the world. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming. I have decided this will be the last week. Can we turn me down just a little bit? The last week to talk about Abraham and Isaac. I was just thinking it through and you know, the fool's errand that I was on was trying to get us into the head and mind and heart of Abraham. But of course, as you know, if you've read Fear and Trembling and understand Kierkegaard, it's ultimately impossible to understand what Abraham did in his willingness to sacrifice his only son. So we're not going to attempt what is impossible. We are just going to spend one more day in this. Hopefully, if it's 2 days, if it turns out that I don't get done by today, then we will eke it out one more day next Sunday. But I'm hoping, I'm not planning on it. We'll see how these things go. So let's just say 2 more days because we know how these things go, and then we'll content ourselves with that, and we will move on. I leave tomorrow for my annual Hajj into the wilderness. For 5 days and, going up to Yosemite and just being alone, which is no, commentary on my family at all. I love being with them very much and it's difficult not to be with them, but this is necessary and good. So I will be away with no phone, no nothing, just me and God and a few bears. Apparently there are a lot of bears on the JMT part where I'm going to be hiking. But that'll be good because I've been told black bears are docile. So they're cute. We'll snuggle together at night because it's supposed to be cold down into the high teens, low 20s. So it'll be a fun challenge. But I will fully expect to see you all here next week. And you should expect me to be here as well. So Kierkegaard was almost an exact contemporary of Victor Hugo. Of The Hunchback of Notre Dame and Les Miserables fame. Hugo was 10 years his senior, but they died the same year in 1855, just a few years before the American Civil War. And the difference, Hugo was considered the last and greatest of maybe sort of the French romantics. And what Victor Hugo was able to do through his work was critique the contemporary 20th century world or 19th century world using contemporary categories. What Kierkegaard did that was different than Victor Hugo and the other French and German romantics was he critiqued the 19th century world with a 20th century perspective. He was a man ahead of his time in many, many respects. And all the rage of the 19th century German and French romantics was kindling an interest in the great legends and myths and folk tales of old. And they were trying to recapture, hence the term romantics, trying to recapture the profundity of those old ancient legends and myths for contemporary society. What Kierkegaard did was he went back to an ancient story also, but one that he didn't believe was a myth or a legend or a fairy tale, but that was actually true, that actually really happened. That was actually more fantastic than any of the myths or legends or fairy tales that the German and French romantics were trying to revive. And Kierkegaard was interested in doing this as a literary technique because a lot of people were recovering these ancient stories. But he did it as a theological exercise too, because he had an inkling that at the bottom of this story of Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac was the sort of the key to the mystery of faith, that something happened there that made Abraham the father of faith, that something mysterious happened there, and that if we can begin to even think seriously about that story, we can begin to plumb the greatest and most profound depths of faith. So that was his interest, and that's what he wanted to do. He also wanted to rebut Hegel's philosophical influence, which was also all the rage in the mid-19th century. Hegel had invented a philosophical system that finally got to the truth of things. And in the process of developing this system, this sort of Hegelian method, he saw a place for religion, saw a place for faith, but it was a handmaiden to philosophy. Philosophy was the true way to get to ultimate truth. Religion was a way, but it wasn't the cleanest, most systematic way of getting at the truth. And a lot of people, including many people in the church, were completely influenced by Hegel. And they took this sort of head-first approach into faith. And in fact, Kierkegaard's position on it was that people had done this at the expense of what true faith really actually is. So he decided, I'm going to write works and I'm going to examine things like true faith, looking at the story of Abraham and Isaac, because Hegel's hubris was something that Kierkegaard just couldn't get his mind around. He couldn't let it go. Not only was Hegel's hubris centered on the fact that philosophy was deeper than religion, but that you could systematize life to begin with. The fact that Hegel just assumed that you could systematically sort of understand what life was all about just drove Kierkegaard nuts. And one of the reasons that Kierkegaard thought it was such hubris for Hegel to attempt even that is because he believed that the whole of existence cannot be systematized because it is not yet whole. The whole of existence is not yet whole. It's still a work in progress. It's not a completed work. It's incomplete, and it's in a state of constant development. So Hegel can't possibly be right that whatever he's systematizing is something of his own creation. It's a limited system at best, and it's not something that that people should fall headlong into believing. It just simply is. It's not right. And so Kierkegaard was having none of it, and he said that genuine faith, which he always contrasted with the counterfeit faith of conventional Christianity. He said that what most people walk around, most Christians, self-proclaimed Christians, walk around doing is something other than faith. It's sort of the precursors to faith, but it's not actual faith that these, in his particular case, Danish Christians and the official Lutheran Church, that's not faith. It's some counterfeit measure of faith that's not at all what it's supposed to be. But genuine faith, because life is incomplete, because our knowledge is incomplete, because it's still a work in progress, genuine faith is ultimately faith in the mysterious, what he actually called the absurd. It's a willingness to grasp the absurdity of life and even, frankly, the absurdity of faith. That faith is acknowledging that it really is, in some sense, it begins there. So, which means then that this existential commitment, because for him, this book, Fear and Trembling, really invented a new literary genre, existentialist literature. It's why he's called the father of existentialism. He was taking an approach to the question of existence, hence existential, from a literary, psychological, philosophical, theological, devotional, this is what Fear and Trembling is. And it's this examination of what existence actually means, and that if we can plumb the depths of existence through a story like Abraham and Isaac, we will really understand not only what life means, but what faith means. What it means to have faith in God, but we have to plumb the depths of this, which then means that actual Christian living, the actual faith of a Christian, is deeply uncomfortable. It's deeply existential. It's and finally, he said, indefensible. You can't defend it in a legal courtroom. You can't defend it with a scientific treatise. You can't organize it around a philosophical system. It is ultimately absurd. And we have to recognize its absurdity. And if we don't, then we're not really genuinely Christians from Kierkegaard's point of view. Which is why last week I read to you that prolonged and torturous Sermon on the Mount all in one sitting, which I'm not even quite sure Jesus did. The gospel writers did it, but I have a feeling they just took his greatest hits and conflated them. And so basically what we got was Jesus' greatest hits last week, and probably a lot of us wanted to change the channel. But if you were paying attention, and some of you were, and some of you just, I saw it on your face, you were like actively denying everything I was saying. I'm kidding. But it should have made you uncomfortable. It certainly made me uncomfortable reading through the Sermon on the Mount, and it should make all of us uncomfortable. But I read it to remind us, and Kierkegaard, his whole approach was to remind his readers that the existential commitment required to be a Christian, the one that we see happening with Abraham in his sacrifice of Isaac, his only son, whom he loved, Isaac, as the writer reminds us four times, again and again and again, how much Abraham loved Isaac. That though it was a one-off in the sense that Abraham did something, I'm hearing music, that Abraham did something that none of us would probably be willing to do. In fact, quite certainly we wouldn't. And maybe not even able to do. But it was nonetheless what we are expected to try to achieve. We are, Kierkegaard thought, as a true Christian who reaches the religious stage, which was the final stage we'll talk about here in just a minute, Abraham may have gone further than any of us would have gone, but we need to have the same essential willingness to try to go that far in our commitment to God. Herbert Butterfield, who I've quoted many times before in his quote, professor of history emeritus at Cambridge University, used to say, hold fast to Christ as for all else remain totally uncommitted. Hold fast to Christ as for all else remain totally uncommitted. Wow, well, okay. And Abraham takes that to an infinite degree. He holds fast to God. But we'll talk here about what his commitment to Isaac was. But we need the willingness to embrace the absurd and confront God on God's terms, not on our own. We need to be able to wrestle with God on his terms, not our own terms. That we need to understand that we are not finally in control. That this is something that we have to embrace, that we have to somehow be committed to. This is why Kierkegaard was so critical of Christendom, what I call Christian culture, because he basically believed that it had given us an excuse. It got us off the hook. That the church in his day allowed so-called believers to have their cake and eat it too. To follow Christ, presumably, but also to live a comfortable life. That both could coexist. And Kierkegaard believed that that was the ultimate capitulation. In fact, he has a stronger word for it that we'll talk about in a minute. But that was his problem. So in Fear and Trembling, which he wrote in 1843, he wrote a lot of things in 1843 and 1844 and 1845 and 1846. I mean, he just was crazy. He was nuts. He made Louis L'Amour look like a slacker. Kierkegaard was just publishing things under pseudonyms. Just, it was crazy how much he was publishing. But a few years after Fear and Trembling in 1846, he hints at it in some works he had done prior to Fear and Trembling in 1842. And then he hints at it and talks about it actually in the last part of Fear and Trembling. But he systematizes what I'm about to tell you, a piece of writing he called Stages on Life's Way. And to get a better handle on what's happening in Fear and Trembling, which is his theological, philosophical, devotional attempt to understand Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac, in order to understand that, I think as well as we can, we need to understand what Kierkegaard is doing with these stages on life's way. What does he mean by these stages? What is he talking about? What are these stages on life's way? And stages is the English translation of the Danish, but he would actually sometimes he used the Danish word for stage, but he really actually meant by it, and he used this word more often, spheres of life. They're three stages or three spheres of life that are three-dimensional. They're not just flat stages that you go from one to the next to the next. I mean, you do. There is a trajectory that you take, but that they're three-dimensional. Sometimes they overlap. In fact, they almost always overlap, but they are extremely distinct for a number of different reasons. And the first he called the aesthetic sphere or stage. The second he called the ethical sphere, and the third he called the religious sphere, okay? So this is the rubric that Kierkegaard is using and dealing with when he's writing Fear and Trembling, for example. They're paradigms of existence, is that maybe another way of putting it, multidimensional sort of spheres. And many people, Kierkegaard believed, for example, might not ever reach the religious sphere. They may simply remain in the ethical sphere and mistake it for the religious sphere. But it won't actually be the religious sphere. In fact, Kierkegaard essentially says as much, that most Christians in his day were stuck in the ethical sphere. They had not reached the religious sphere. You can't entirely separate the ethical and the aesthetic from the religious, but they are different. And the religious sphere was the hardest and least frequented of the spheres. So what I want to do is just read a description by Dan Johnson, which I think is really, really well done, in spite of the title of his article, Kierkegaard Stages Towards Authentic Religious Experience and the Bodhisattva Path to Enlightenment. Nonetheless, Dan Johnson's explanation of Kierkegaard's three spheres of life is really helpful and good, and it will help you understand this. So forgive this rather long, I decided not to put it up there just because it's probably just a little easier to follow this way. So this is how he explains the three spheres of life. Now keep in mind that Fear and Trembling is Kierkegaard's attempt to understand a person who fully enters into the religious sphere, Abraham. Okay? So this is what Dan Johnson says. The first two stages, the aesthetic and the ethical, are characterized by a distinct set of beliefs and behavior that is easily identifiable, whereas the last stage, the religious, is characterized by a highly personal, subjective, non-rational leap of faith. So that's the third. So the first two, the aesthetic and the ethical, there are proofs you can provide. You can almost measure the stages people are in that those first two. And we see this in bold relief in Hollywood. As you will see as I explain this, you will immediately start characterizing and categorizing all your friends. So it'll be very helpful for you to see who you should spend your time around. Because you will see people who are stuck in the first stage and have never quite left it. In fact, I would argue that it's because of the first stage that we drove past a bunch of mansions. on the way here. The first stage is the aesthetic, having to do with beauty. This stage is characterized by an indulgence in the pleasurable and beautiful that life has to offer. The aesthetic stage is a necessary one. It's one no one escapes. We're all in it. On the road to authentic religious awareness, but it is one, the aesthetic stage, that is marked with pitfalls and illusory promises of contentment. Also, the person trapped in an aesthetic existence will usually be immature, both physically and spiritually. So, as it turns out, we all start in the aesthetic sphere. It's called childhood. We love beauty. We love pleasurable things. If you ask my son, would he rather eat broccoli or a Snickers bar? Well, I don't know. He doesn't even eat Snickers bars, does he? I don't know what's pleasurable to him. But, you know, I mean, the more presents, the better. Right? The more pleasure, the better. All kids are hedonists. They love to have fun. They love to play. And it is perfectly normal. It would be strange for a five-year-old to be in the ethical stage. You have done something terribly wrong with your child, if that is the case. This is what makes adolescence so incredibly difficult and so challenging, and probably why my daughter left. Because they are in the middle of the aesthetic and the ethical. She says, why is it that we're always treated like kids, but we're expected to act like adults? And I said, you know, it's just the opposite. You're treated like adults, but expected to act like kids. But it's confusing, isn't it? You're in that ethical and ethical stage, and some people are trapped in perpetual adolescence, which defines, I think, a lot of what happens in this town. Anyway, Johnson says that a person trapped in the aesthetic existence will usually be immature both physically and spiritually. One emerges from the aesthetic stage by growing older and becoming more serious about life. Now, growing older and becoming more serious about life are not necessarily the same thing. But typically, for all of us in the room, we have all thankfully escaped the aesthetic stage. And we are in the ethical stage. I am counting on that to be the case. That's why you're here. The people stuck in the aesthetic stage are at home drinking their coffee. Or just going to church and then coming home. But you guys are serious. You guys are ethical people. One emerges from the aesthetic stage by growing older, becoming more serious about life. Actually, one's passionate physical and aesthetic desires are what leads one eventually. So get this. One's passionate physical and aesthetic desires, the ones we had when we were young, are what leads one eventually to the awareness that his existence is profoundly lacking in fulfillment and meaning, right? So you say to yourself, this can't be all that life is about, just having fun and racking one pleasure on top of another. There's got to be more to life than this. I remember experiencing that myself. And this is why it's always a little problematic to talk about these spheres as if they're static spheres, that when one goes back and forth, you know, and I return to an aesthetic sphere in my life, after my first marriage and my divorce, and I was living in Malibu on the beach and enjoying the fruits of not a lot of labor, and I was in sort of that prodigal period, and I was revisiting the aesthetic stage. But apparently God thought, God allowed for me to experience that because I'm more hard-headed than most, and I had to really come to terms with, Is it enough? Like, can I just have fun and just play? And then I re-entered the ethical stage where I realized it's not enough. It's simply not enough. The best that the world has to offer is not enough for me. So you have this profound awareness lacking fulfillment and meaning. Johnson goes on. Kierkegaard had described his own existence in the aesthetic realm as a vain search for anchorage on a boundless sea of pleasure. Who does this remind you of? What great 4th century theologian? Augustine, right? This is Augustine's whole thing. He just was swimming in a sea of pleasure, and he realized this is not what life is about. It's not about gaining experiences of pleasure and power and money and fame and, oh, it's just not that. And so, you know, people go through this. And Kierkegaard realized the aesthetic stage cannot ever lead to becoming a Christian. It's a stage we all go through, and hopefully we move beyond in the main. But it can't ever lead to becoming a Christian. One simply doesn't jump from the aesthetic to the religious. However, as we know, many people do appear to do that. Which is, and I do not mean in any way to belittle this, please note, but I want to put it in context. This is what makes the health and wealth gospel, there are profound camp highs and there are cheap camp highs. But it's what can make a very pleasant version of the Christian faith so problematic, because it allows someone to jump from the aesthetic completely over the ethical and into the religious, or apparently that's what they're doing, right? And that's a very dangerous thing to perpetuate. The second stage, Johnson goes on, is the ethical, okay? This is a stage characterized by one's adherence to duty and obligation. So this is a mature person, the kind of person you want as the pilot of your airplane. You want this as the CEO of your company. You want someone like this as a mentor. You want, heck, in some ways, you know, it's the kind of, the very people we admire. So I go through these strange, weird, you know, experiences in my own life where I will suddenly, like, just be obsessed with certain things. And I am, you know, very interested in spending time in the outdoors. And so that leads me, of course, to be interested in people who spend a lot of time outdoors. And then one thing leads to another. And pretty soon I have spent half an hour looking at ultramarathoners. And don't worry if you didn't quite make the jump. It would be too long to explain, but you can probably assume how I might have made the jump. And so now I am now a surface expert on the greatest ultramarathoners to have ever lived. And apparently there's a whole interesting Mexican tribe of runners who run forever, and all these ultramarathoners are trying to do what they do. And I start to get into it, and I start to think, wow, these people are incredibly impressive. Look at these people. In fact, I got a book that I haven't even admitted to my wife yet. I hope she's not here. That I'm going to listen to on the way up to my Hajj into the wilderness. And it's this guy who is like serious. He's like the toughest guy in the world. He's the only man ever to have been a Navy SEAL and passed the test for Air Force Ranger and SEAL team group. I mean, this guy's just awesome. Like, he's a god. He's like a titan. And he wrote a book, and I'm like, I'm going to listen to this on the way up to my hike in Yosemite, and I'm just going to be a titan. But what these people are, you cannot, I mean, listen, you can't, and apparently he believes in God, because he throws God around almost as often as he drops the F-bomb. And he's, you know, this super, he's a warrior. These guys that we admire, I mean, the people in business we admire, the people in exercise that we admire, the people who are intellects that we admire, Kierkegaard would say these people are absolutely prime examples of people in that ethical stage who know rules, who are disciplined, who are intense, who you admire, who you want to be like, and it's, wow, these people are great. So this is a stage characterized by one's adherence to duty and obligation. From a moral perspective, he says, this is the moral life. It's living by standards and codes of conduct that have been set up by society, by the state, by Christendom, even by oneself. This stage is mostly a transitory stage in that one does not really stay within this realm in any consistent manner. By that he means you go back to the aesthetic stage. And I read these ultramarathoners. They did that. They ultramarathon, and then they'd slack off, and then they'd get back. And, you know, we all do that. At our very best, C.S. Lewis called it the law of undulation. Sometimes we have good days, sometimes we have bad days. Sometimes we're paragons of virtue, some days we're embarrassed at looking in the mirror. Some days, you know, it's a bit transitory. The best example of this stage is found in Fear and Trembling, where Kierkegaard describes Abraham as fighting within himself to transcend the ethical and suspend it in order to enter into a personal relationship with the infinite God. Abraham is struggling now, in this case, not between the aesthetic and the ethical, but in his case, between the ethical and the religious. It's a huge, titanic struggle. The ethical stage, Johnson continues, is a mode of existence one lives in that allows for the religious to come about. So it is the batter's box. It's the setting stage for one's growth into the religious sphere that moves beyond laws, beyond rules. It's hard to say this, but I'm going to spend the next half an hour backing it up. It's sort of kind of moving beyond rules. It's like the Pharisees were super, super ethical. They were really good people. I mean, they followed the rules, and there were a lot of them to follow, and they were really the kind of people that were super impressive. And you really, if you had been in first century Israel and had been a Jew, you would have looked up to them. You would have admired them. Probably even the Greeks admired them. But, he says, the ethical stage is a mode of existence that one that allows for the religious to come about, but it stands in direct opposition to the religious. Isn't that interesting? It allows the religious to come about, but it actually stands in direct opposition to the religious. The ethical is safe, secure, understandable. It is dutiful. And the individual as well as the crowd can measure his adherence or her adherence or non-adherence to the ethical norms laid down by society by his performance of these duties and responsibilities. The ethical person is one who is matured to be able to see the fallacy of the aesthetic of always living for pleasure and is settling down in certainty to perform the prescribed conduct. That is what, you know, these are good people. For people for whom living a moral life is really important. It's the right thing to do. These are people who really care about right and wrong. But note, Kierkegaard said that is the ethical stage, which stands in direct opposition to the religious stage. So that's the final stage, and this is how Johnson ends. The pass into the religious stage or sphere must be a leap. But once an individual has leapt into the religious, it is as though one can never really stay there in any fixed or static sense. The religious awakening is an infinite and terrible experience. Terrible because it has no recourse to the normal conventions that usually govern one's life. Reason, rational inquiry, objective analysis. None of these faculties that work so well in the first two stages has any meaning in the final stage. One has entered a higher realm of existence, or maybe lower, in this sense of servanthood. The highest attainable on earth as a human being, but one that is marked by paradox. And it can only be attained is, I don't like that word, with the help of the Holy Spirit, with the aid of God. One can only enter the religious sphere with God's help and invitation and power and the gift of faith. One can only enter the religious sphere. One can enter the ethical sphere by one's own discipline. By one's own commitment to goodness. The paradoxical nature of the religious experience is seen in the way in which it cannot be communicated. It cannot be discussed rationally or logically analyzed. But it is the most profound event in one's life, and it is full of meaning. Thus, one enters into the realm of subjective truth as opposed to objective truth, which is something you can prove and measure. And this is subjective truth. To be in a state of subjective truth is to truly be oneself. It is a highly personal mode of existence. A religious person, according to Kierkegaard, is only truly an existing individual when the religious stage is attained. Up until that point, we are allowing other things other than God to tell us who we are and communicate to us what matters and what is important. We're allowing the state, even to some degree the church, oneself, rules. The religious person becomes aware of his or her own individuality in a way that is impossible while he's still in the ethical stage. Because in the ethical stage, we're always comparing ourselves to someone else. Am I as good as that person? Am I better than that person? I hope I'm not as bad as that person. It is as if blinders are removed from one's eyes and one is able to see oneself in a completely new way. Consequently, one sees everyone else then as an individual as well. When you reach the religious stage, Kierkegaard argued, you can no longer see people as objects, as means to ends. You can't objectify people because you, in coming to a subjective awareness of yourself, you simultaneously come into a subjective awareness of everyone else's self. So it may look initially very narcissistic, but it is just the opposite of that. You have come to terms with the profundity of yourself in relationship to God. So now you understand everyone else in their profundity, in their relationship to God. You cannot objectify them anymore. Everyone becomes a subject, not an object. This is what Kant meant when you treat others as ends, not as means to an end. So to treat someone as a means to an end, even if the end is glorious and wonderful and good, is ultimately the opposite of faith. So if you have someone, for example, who is in high office, who you may not like, but they are a means to a greater end, that is not a religious impulse. It is the exact opposite of it, because you are treating that person as a means to an end. If you are, I mean, this is we it turns out we do it all the time. Then the last couple sentences. The ethical, however, is never completely left behind, which is what makes the religious sphere so intense in some respects. It does not disappear when one leaps into the religious stage, but it is only suspended. It's not eradicated. It's not as if when someone enters the religious sphere, they are no longer answerable to ethical norms. They still are, as was Abraham, in his own self. He was answerable to what he was about to do to his son, his only son, who he loved, Isaac. So you don't let yourself off the hook. Like, oh, good, ethical standards no longer apply to me. Isn't that lovely? Now I can do whatever the hell I want because God has called me to do this. No. You're still, there's this dialectical tension, to use a Hegelian term, but there's, which wouldn't make Kierkegaard very happy, but actually he called it a dialectic, where you're struggling within yourself. And this suspension at certain points of the ethical leads to the point that all of the three stages cannot be thought of as hard and fast categories with no overlap. On the contrary, Kierkegaard himself says that he never really left the first two. They are always there, and one moves in and out of all three. So if we are true, thoughtful, aware human beings who live a somewhat self-examined life, we will definitely, certainly see in each one of us, or in ourself, the aesthetic and the ethical. Some of us may indeed see in themselves the religious. I'm not sure I see it in myself. I don't really know. I mean, maybe. I'm not sure. But even if I did, I wouldn't be able to communicate it, because as soon as I'm communicating, I'm trying to justify it ethically to you. Do you see what I'm saying? So a truly religious person, whether they're aware of it or not, you would never know, because they'd never talk to you about it. Because they can't. Because then they're looking for some kind of, you know, admiration from you or a justification. So they're existentially different spheres with different fixed points, different goals, different views of the self and of others and of God. But they are not ultimately incompatible. They are in persistent conflict. And this is what it means then, this is what it means to be a believer, is that you are wrestling with God all the time. That's literally as good as it gets. And that wrestling in itself becomes life-sustaining. It becomes the journey. It's a journey of wrestling. This is why, my family will tell you, I do these little wilderness hajjas once a year. I'm not looking forward to hiking 35 miles with a 30-pound pack in 25, 35-degree weather. But I'm trying to, for myself, I'm trying to embody what I want my spiritual life to be. I want it to be a good struggle, a joyful struggle, not a despairing struggle. No, who wants to be around people like that? That's no fun, and that draws attention to itself in its own way. But a joyful struggle. So fear and trembling stands at the crossroads between the ethical and the religious. This is the leap that Abraham made from one to the other. It's the struggle, and one of the reasons that so many of us find the story so disturbing, because a story like Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac, it stands in repudiation of us. It stands as a sort of a condemnation. It scrutinizes and threatens our comfortable existence. It reminds us that we cannot get too high on our horse about being ethical people. That as long as we can communicate that to other people and show to the world that we're actually pretty decent people, we have not entered the religious stage. And again, the ethical stage isn't a bad stage, but it is not the final stage. It's not the stage of faith, as Kierkegaard said. It threatens our existence. And this is a quote from Newhouse that I wanted to just put up here. He's quoting Kierkegaard, "To become again a child, to become as nothing, without any selfishness, to become again a youth, notwithstanding one has become shrewd, shrewd by experience, shrewd in worldly wisdom." This is sort of Paul Ricoeur's second naivete. It's not the naivete that happens before experience, it's the naivete that comes after experience. It's what Jesus meant when he said, unless you become like a child. So to become again a child, to become as nothing, without any selfishness, to become again a youth, notwithstanding one has become shrewd, shrewd by experience, shrewd in worldly wisdom, and then to despise the thought of behaving shrewdly, to will to be a youth, to will to retain youth's enthusiasm with its spontaneity unabated, to will to reacquire it by valiant effort. Yes, that is the task, Kierkegaard said. And then Newhouse ends, "The grown-ups, however, those who are shrewd in worldly wisdom, have built secure defenses against being encountered by Christ, and they will not let him in." It sounds to me like a wonderful definition of a Presbyterian. That we have developed all these defenses so that we don't look too silly, too youthful, too enthusiastic. Want things done orderly. We like things, you know, that you can quantify. And Kierkegaard challenges us in the same way that Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac challenges us. In the same way that Flannery O'Connor's stories challenge us. I find that the compatibility of O'Connor and Kierkegaard, gosh, I would have loved it if they had gotten married and had kids. It would been so interesting to see how those kids would have turned out. They would have been complete misfits that either went on a murdering rampage or they were literally the second coming. And maybe both. This is precisely why Kierkegaard thought that the great enemy of genuine Christianity was Christendom. The great enemy of genuine Christianity, according to Kierkegaard, was Christian culture. He called it the great blasphemy. The organized church, Lutheran church, in Denmark in the 1800s, you can only speak for that, was the great blasphemy because it let followers off the hook with an official stamp of approval from the church. Yes, you may follow Christ and be comfortable all at the same time. It is perfectly okay. In fact, you can become a leader in the church. We are given a free pass. We are told that by golly, we can have our existential cake and eat it too. That we can live comfortable lives and still be genuine Christians. It's our birthright. It's our destiny. But as another commentator put it, the story of Abraham's willingness to sacrifice Isaac disturbs our genial assumptions that religious faith simply means being a nice, ethical person. I wish Belle were here. I would embarrass her right now because she has a fun little habit of memorizing Shakespeare quotes. And this is a quote from Shakespeare that I have not memorized, but she just digs Will, both Wills, both her son and Shakespeare. And there's some quote, maybe one of you knows it, where, and I'm just going to bastardize it, it's not right, but how being kind and being good are not the same thing. And that we mistake one for the other. That if one is kind, one must be good. Or that if one is good, one must necessarily be kind. And they are not the same thing. And so Abraham's story of his willingness to sacrifice Isaac disturbs our genial assumptions that religious faith, Christianity, means simply being a nice, ethical person. And this is why, as you can probably imagine, I find Kierkegaard so congenial to my own way of thinking, because he's so like Flannery O'Connor, who has had such a profound effect on me and my own faith. They both acknowledged, ultimately, the absurdity of faith, that it's crazy, that in the story A Good Man is Hard to Find, that Flannery O'Connor wrote, probably her most anthologized short story, where a misfit, quite literally he is referred to as the misfit, murders an entire family, and then it turns out that it's just him and the grandmother at the end of the story, and the grandmother is the ultimate ethical person. She's been a churchgoer all her life. Yes, 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 she has the southern categories of racism, but she's nice to the blacks. She treats them with respect. She has good manners. She's incredibly well-mannered, in fact. She's very, just very nice. And she comes face to face, literally, with the misfit, who's on a murderous rampage. And it turns out that they have a discussion right at the end of the story before he shoots her between the eyes. And she's saying, but you're a good Christian man, aren't you? And he says, yeah, but Jesus thrown everything off. Jesus thrown everything off. I don't like it. I don't like the way Jesus threw everything off. Now we can't do what we want. Now we can't just live in the aesthetic stage. We can't even live in the ethical. We you know what? To hell with it all then. The best you can do is be mean for a while. That's the most fun. That's the most pleasure, is just to have your own fun. You can be mean either by shooting people between the eyes or by just keeping as much money to yourself as possible at the expense of others. I mean, we can be mean in all kinds of different ways. And then the grandmother, much to her own, I'm sure, surprise and maybe embarrassment, but she is, after all, at the receiving end of a gun, she has an epiphany, and it is a genuine epiphany, and she sees the misfit as her own son. You see what happened? She entered the religious stage, and O'Connor was very well aware of Kierkegaard. The grandmother had entered the religious stage. She could no longer objectify the misfit as a misfit, which is what society had. He had broken out of prison with his buddies, right? Because he was a misfit. Well, the misfit even calls Jesus a misfit. Kind of interesting. But she finally recognizes him for the eternal, eternally beautiful creation of God. And she says, well, you're one of my boys. You're my son. And at that moment, the misfit shoots her in the head because he can't stand the truth of what she just said, because it would ruin his whole approach to life. He can't take it. And then he has that great, one of the great lines in American literature. She comes to, it's literally a deathbed conversion. And the misfit says about the grandmother, she would have been a good woman if someone had been there to shoot her every second of her life. If she had been placed in that position where it was a matter of life and death, then she would have entered that religious stage. But until then, she was contenting herself with the ethical stage. So O'Connor and Kierkegaard are just two peas in a pod, and they both acknowledge the ultimate absurdity of faith, which demands of us things sometimes that are ultimately irrational, possibly even immoral by culture's standards, which is why Abraham's responsibility is so lonely, Kierkegaard says. He's finally alone. There is only one father of the faith, and it's Abraham, no one else. Because no one can enter where he went. And even if they could, even if they did, they wouldn't be able to talk about it. He literally cannot talk about it. It's not a choice of his. He simply is unable to speak, Kierkegaard says. Because every attempt at trying to talk about it is an attempt to rationalize it. And you can't rationalize that final step. So he literally is alone. He cannot share the experience with Sarah. He can't explain it to Isaac. He is existentially wrought. But this is where Kierkegaard then takes it another level. Abraham, he calls it the teleological suspension of the ethical, where for a moment, Abraham was willing to suspend his moral, ethical obligation to protect his son, his only son, whom he loved, Isaac. And the reason it was so lonely for Abraham was because he didn't love Isaac any less. He loved him more than he had ever loved him before. And simultaneously, he is committed to God's call to sacrifice him. So it becomes, that story is the pinnacle of what it means to be existentially wrought. But it explodes those categories, and then Kierkegaard, he's not done yet, says, and Abraham does it joyfully. That's that last part of Fear and Trembling, where he is not a tragic hero. A tragic hero would have done it with infinite resignation. I love my son, but I have to kill him for the good of... That's what a tragic hero does. And Kierkegaard brings up three classic tragic heroes, Agamemnon and others, as these were tragic heroes who made this incredible sacrifice, but they did it for the sake of the army, the Greek army, or they did it for the sake of whatever. They were doing it for the greater good. Abraham can't make that claim. In fact, quite the opposite. He was literally killing the one thing that had been promised to him as the seed from which all the nations of the world, all those stars that he saw, he was actually doing society a wrong by doing this. And he certainly wasn't protecting his son. He could make no claims to tragic heroism. He was not a tragic hero. He was, Kierkegaard says, a man of faith, of genuine faith, who was literally willing, joyfully so, to sacrifice the single most important thing in his entire life, and to do it joyfully while loving Isaac all the more, trusting God. This is what O'Connor means by faith is not certainty, faith is trust. It is existential trust. And this is the part that Kierkegaard says no words can explain. We must simply stop. This is why I think C.S. Lewis stops in by his own admission, his favorite novel, Till We Have Faces. It ends with an ellipsis when Orwell is you know, it's his retelling of the myth of Cupid and Psyche, and Orol has always been jealous of her sister who always gets all the accolades, and so she's making a claim in this cave with the gods, and she's claiming, and finally they just say, "Stop! Are you done? Are you done justifying yourself? Are you done bitching and moaning about life? Are you done?" And Orwell realizes that if she hadn't been interrupted, she would have gone on forever bitching and moaning and talking about what a great sacrifice she had made. And the gods had to stop her. And then Lewis literally does, he interrupts himself in the narrative, which is such a lovely literary rhetorical tool he uses. He literally breaks off mid-sentence, where Orwell says, "Had I not been stopped, what would I have done? I would have gone on complaining, or I could have ... And I think what the reader is meant to do is speculate, or I could have loved, which is where Kierkegaard ends. That the jump into the leap into the religious sphere does not leave the ethical behind in some convenient way. Had Abraham actually sacrificed Isaac, he would have been liable to murder, Kierkegaard said, and rightfully so. According to the Old Testament, he would have been put to death, and as he should have. That would be the right ethical thing to do. And Abraham was perfectly well aware of this. It was the end of everything. But he doesn't do it as a tragic hero. He does it joyfully, not happily, right? But joyfully, because he does not give up on the promises of God. So in the last just few minutes, let me see if I can do this. We get into the second half of the book, which we simply can't go through in any detail. But it's the problems that are raised with this whole thing. How do we confront this? And Kierkegaard says there are three major conundrums that we are faced with in looking at this story. And so this is how he does it. He calls this the teleological suspension of the ethical. This faith compels one to trust an unethical action will result in a better end according to the promises of God. Abraham didn't know how it would end. He assumed it would end with his son Isaac's death, but that wasn't all. That would have just been resignation. But there was a leap of faith that said, it's got to end better. I don't know how. I can't possibly imagine it. Will he be raised from the dead? Will there be a new Isaac? Will we get pregnant? I have no idea, but I believe. So off we go. And humans by themselves have no recourse for understanding this. Only God in his infinite wisdom can make such sense of a request. So this is the request that's made. Then the problems are raised with this. And these three problems Kierkegaard raises to show that Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac doesn't make sense in light of a conventional faith. For any of us who may have a conventional faith, this story simply does not make sense. It just doesn't. The first problem is whether faith really does require a teleological suspension of the ethical. Really? Well, yes, Kierkegaard says, it absolutely does. Doesn't mean that we're always going around suspending the ethical, but it requires a willingness to do so, as Abraham was willing to do. And this is how Kierkegaard puts it, that Abraham was actually tempted by his ethical duty. Since when last time were you tempted by ethics? He's tempted by his ethical duty to protect his one and only son, Isaac, whom he loves. It reminds me again of one of O'Connor's stories. I've said it to you before in Revelation. Good Man is Hard to Find was one of her early stories. Revelation was one of her last, where the protagonist, Ruby Turpin, is another woman just like the grandmother, who's perfectly well-mannered, is nice to all the slaves that work for her on her farm, and perfectly good, and dresses up, and she and her husband, who's the mousiest character in all of American literature, they just kind of obey and do their thing, and then she is hit over the head by some young teenage girl in a hospital because she's, you know, the old woman, Ruby Serpent, is making all these little pronouncements on all these people, and the young girl can't stand it and throws her a book at her, hits her in the head and calls her an old warthog from hell. And then the woman happens to own a hog farm, so that was kind of ironic, and she's in the hog bin, and then it reminds you of the prodigal son. She's feeding the hogs, and boom, she has a revelation just like the grandmother did at the end of A Good Man Is Hard to Find. And she sees a whole line of people heading into heaven, and the people in the front are the people she has always disdained, the ones that she was sort of politely disdaining the poor white trash, she called, and O'Connor, as you know, uses the N-word in her stories because it draws out the real fundamental meaning of how these people were subjugated by culture. And she says, all the white trash and all the niggers, they were in the front of the line. And people like me and my husband, we were in the back. And we had all these horrified looks on our faces, and all these other people are dancing through the fire where even their virtues were being burned away. The ethical stage was being burned. Our claims to goodness and righteousness were being dashed, because that's what redemption does. It doesn't just burn away the bad in us, it burns away the perceived good. And this is what Abraham enters into. The second and third problems, really quickly, is do we really have an absolute duty to God? Like, can it finally trump ethics? And Kierkegaard says, absolutely. In faith, it must. Because if all you're being is an ethical person, you don't need God to do that. You can be a good person without God. Perfectly possible. I mean, as society would define it. Law-abiding, living a decent life. People do it all the time. That can't possibly be. If that's all it is, if all the Christian faith is living a good life, then Abraham is sunk. He's lost. He's a terrible example of faith. He's the worst possible example. So he says, absolutely, we have an absolute duty to God. So the universal, in Kierkegaard's view, now he's responding to Hegel, the universal is actually relative. The absolute is the individual's relationship with God. Martin Luther even said this, you know, you come into life alone and you leave it alone. It's between you and your maker. And then the third problem is, can't Abraham really ever talk about it with anyone? Like, can he lie down one night years later and say to Sarah, can I tell you what happened? Can we talk about it? Or maybe he sits down with Isaac and says, can I explain to you what happened? Kierkegaard says, no way. Because that leap is ultimately irrational. It's not rational by cultural standards. You cannot explain it, defend it. He literally was unable to speak. If you could speak it, it would be ethics, not faith. And then finally, he ends with, faith is the highest passion in a person, Kierkegaard said. It's a passion. Faith is not a reason for believing. What everyone calls faith isn't faith at all, Kierkegaard said, but only the reasons one might have for faith. Actual faith requires a leap of passion, of trust. That is the thing itself. His concern, and I think his defiant conclusion in the book, was that faith had become a kind of mental assent or moral system or even ethical resignation to do one's duty in front of God. But he said faith is none of those things. Those were all things that come prior to faith. It's willingness to embrace the absurd. So we end with just the last few minutes with this story again, and I want to read it one more time. And I want you to notice one thing as I finish this. And I managed to get through, so thank you for letting me go a little extra. Notice how the sentences, whoever told this story, whoever it was a literary genius, because the sentences, you'll notice, the first sentences jump over days of time, possibly even weeks of time. But as the story narrows, notice how the tension is raised. And I use this story, actually, I remember explaining to Belle when she was in about fourth grade how you can manipulate time with story. And that's what makes it suspenseful. You don't need a movie, or you can do it with a book. Stephen King does it better than most, right? Where you can say, the man walked into the house and he ran up the stairs, and you know, you're doing things very quickly. And then he turned and started to walk down the hall, and he noticed the door just ahead of him, and he took his hand out of his pocket and he reached for the doorknob and he began to turn it slowly. See, now you guys are all wondering what's going to happen. And notice what happens in this story. After all this, God tested Abraham. God said, "Abraham." "Yes," he answered, "I'm listening." He said, "Take your son, your only son, who you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I'll point out to you." Abraham got up early in the morning and saddled his donkey. He took two of his young servants and his son Isaac. He had split wood for the burnt offering. He set out for the place God had directed him. On the third day, he looked up and saw the place in the distance. Abraham told his two young servants, "Stay here with the donkey. The boy and I are going over there to worship. Then we'll come back to you." Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and gave it to Isaac, his son, to carry. He carried the flint and the knife. The two of them went off together. Isaac said to Abraham, his father, "Father?" "Yes, my son." "We have flint and wood, but where's the sheep for the burnt offering?" "Son, God will see to it that there's a sheep for the burnt offering." And they kept on walking together. They arrived at the place which God had directed him. Abraham built the altar. He laid out the wood. Then he tied up Isaac and laid him on the wood. Abraham reached out and took the knife to kill his son. Just then, an angel of God called to him out of the heavens, "Abraham, Abraham." "Yes, I'm listening." "Don't lay a hand on that boy. Don't touch him. Now I know how fearlessly you fear God. You didn't hesitate to place your son, your dear son, on the altar for me." Okay, we don't have time for questions. Thank God. So we'll see you next week.